Hello, I'm Paige, and this is the Euro Intelligence Podcast covering current affairs in the EU and Euro area. I am joined by Wolfgang and Susanna, directors of Euro Intelligence in Oxford. Guys, the big story this week was the G7 summit, today the NATO summit, and soon the EU-US summit. Wolfgang, you made the very difficult argument that in order to govern, you have to make choices, and that this could include choosing to address climate change before addressing human rights concerns. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, we talked about I wrote about the trade-off we ultimately have to face in our foreign policy about whether we prioritize climate change or whether we prioritize human rights. In an ideal world, you do everything. It's just that, A, we don't live in an ideal world, and B, we've tried everything, and trying to, you know, commingle all these goals hasn't really worked for us all that well. We're all behind on the climate change targets. Human rights abuses abound. Russia, China, Belarus, even, you know, some countries in the EU are less democratic today than they were a few years ago. We can't say that the West has been particularly successful. And the climate change catastrophe is not just about the climate. It is about the economic consequences. It is about migration. It's about poverty. And you could say it is about the fundamental human rights of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. In an indirect way, it is a human rights agenda, but not the kind of democracy, civil rights type of agenda that we have been pursuing in the past. It's of a different quality, and it's indirect. And the point I have been making, that climate change is such an overwhelmingly important target that you cannot dilute it with secondary and tertiary targets in a broad-based foreign policy agenda. Now, I have a certain hope, maybe naively, that the Biden administration may be the first of a sort of modern administration that may pursue the sort of modern foreign policy, which is very different from the kind of foreign policy diplomacy that we've been used to. Mm. It would involve, if you wanted to succeed on climate change, you will need to involve countries you would not normally, you know, cooperate with. You cannot fight a cold war with China and see yourself in a confrontation with China and yet try to co-opt China into a climate change agenda. The same is with Russia. Russia, while not a large economy, and Russia is still a hugely important factor in global climate change. The Arctic, it is the biggest Arctic country. And any climate change agenda will involve the cooperation of Russia and, of course, of Brazil, too. Mm. So the foreign policy will need to shift gear if it were to succeed in creating a global agenda. We also talked about Nord Stream 2 and about good and bad arguments. You can, you know, the Americans have made the argument against Nord Stream 2 in terms of, you know, what are the strategic security implications. You can look at it from a sort of military perspective, but you can also look at it from a fossil fuel perspective, because what Nord Stream 2 does, it makes Europe more dependent not only on Russian gas, but on gas in general and on fossil fuels. If you combine that with the late exit from coal, which is not for another 20 years, you can see that the EU is, despite all this debate about targets, is very, very likely to miss its interim targets for climate change, no matter what the Greens are saying, no matter what the Constitutional Court is demanding in Germany. The reality of a continued dependence on gas and coal will ensure that this will happen. So this is what a climate change foreign policy will focus on. It will intend to ensure, it will focus on the exit from fossil fuels. It will focus on renewables. It will focus on the preservation of rainforests on the Arctic. It's not that the policy will, there's still, you know, still big parameters that can be shifted. It becomes less over the years. It would have been better had we started this 10, 20 years ago. And the longer we wait, the worse it will be. That's unsurprising. But we are still in a position to avert some of the big catastrophes, the big human catastrophes from climate change. And that is a policy action worth pursuing. And as we've been arguing also, given the G7's increasingly irrelevance, I mean, the Cornwall summit was a, you know, was a nice junket, but it it didn't do much. And we've been going through this now year after year with these sort of highly publicized events, but very low on substance. Mm-hmm. There is a case now of this could give the G7 a new meaning, because these are seven countries that could actually lead on this particular issue. You will not get that leadership from the G20, and you will not get this from any of the existing international institutions. So it will have to be, you know, if there's any group, any multilateral group that could push this, it is the G7.
I would also say, we look at all these negotiations from a human-centric kind of view, talking about the actors and what are the negotiation positions, what are the security implementations. But shifting it to environment would actually mean it puts it into a broader context where it's less human-centric, or the objectives are less human-centric, and you would not be trapped by thinking about it in a game theoretical kind of way of negotiation, and would actually have to look at more closely of where you can reach consensus and what do you have to do in terms of mediating these very difficult negotiations. So you would actually turn your goalposts into a totally different terrain. It's more like peace talks than a sort of a confrontational negotiation over bargaining.
That will be quite hard for the foreign policy crowd, because they're kind of used to the adversarial, you know, model, the good and bad, and all that. That's going to be very difficult for them. Virtually all the infrastructure in the foreign policy world is modeled on confrontation. We're not saying it'll happen. We're saying, you know, that would be something worthwhile pursuing. But am I optimistic? I don't think I am.
Me too. When you consider that climate change poses such an existential threat to humanity, I mean, I like the metaphor of kind of having peace negotiations, because it does seem like this is a crisis that, you know, could kill the entire planet. And yet still to be unable to reach consensus on changing behavior in order to prevent it, it seems to me, I don't want to get too negative on a Monday morning, but I'm sad to hear that you're less than optimistic about the prospects there.
Well, I'm less than optimistic because I know how policymaking works in the G7. Yeah. And I know, you know, what will it take, ask yourself, what will it take for Germany to abandon its mercantilism? What will it take for America to abandon its wish to be ahead of China as in the technology race, which it still is, but China is challenging the US and most likely win to win in some sectors of the technology segment. There are a lot of behavioral patterns that would have to change. I mean, the EU would have to stop being sort of a producer's cartel and think, you know, and set strategic goals, which it has never done. So, you know, you're asking pretty much every actor in that group to reinvent themselves. And, you know, the experience has shown that if they're faced with a mighty challenge, they usually prefer to muddle through rather than actually do big steps. That's the experience. And as policy observer, we tend to look at the things we know, the stuff we know they have always done, revealed preferences, as economists call it. That's usually a better guide for the future than what you think is the right choice. I mean, we've been through the Eurozone crisis and we solved it, you know, every week. But the solution was never taken up because there was always a reason not to do this. And, you know, I don't see any reason why climate change should fall in a different pattern unless one or two actors take a big step. Now, that can still happen. It would require some different folk in Europe and government. That may still happen. We've been talking about the Greens in Germany, maybe one day taking a lead there. There may be a change in US politics. Maybe Biden develops a new foreign policy doctrine. So there may be a fortuitous combination of world leaders that might take a lead here. With Merkel in Germany and Macron in France and Boris Johnson in the UK, we don't quite see this yet. Mm-hmm. And whether Biden is the man, we've been already 6 months into or 5 months into his presidency. And, you know, we haven't seen much, frankly, on foreign policy. Now, it might still be early days. You know, most U.S. presidents don't develop their foreign policy in that short amount of time. And so, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. I mean, there may be, you know, there are some indications, certainly, from the State Department that there is some new thinking going on. But it's not clear that this is yet mature. I think they're kind of naive about the Europeans. I mean, I know that priority has been to engulf the Europeans into a new relationship, and, you know, they're giving in on Nord Stream 2, so that'll happen. but I fear they're not going to get much in return. And that, you know, there is a danger that instead of a new strategic shift, they're just going soft. And that would probably be the worst of all worlds, because, you know, they will, when they realize, not if, but when they realize that the Europeans are not delivering their part of the bargain, there may well be a backlash in the United States, which could come either from a Republican or Democrat administration. It will be harder to maintain the transatlantic alliance with Europe. Now, you've been writing about China today, about the China aspect of the summit. How much progress did they make on China at the G7?
Well, the headlines are very positive for the EU adopting a harder stance against China, certainly. And this is stemming from the joint communique that they issued, which mentioned several issues where the EU has been dragging its feet, most notably forced labor in Xinjiang, and of course, the importance of peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait, which is notable for Europe because they don't usually actually mention Taiwan in any of their public statements. So it's, I suppose, in the headlines, a step in the right direction. They've also got that $100 billion global decarbonization program that is kind of seen as a counter to China's Belt and Road Initiative. But as you mentioned before, what will it take to get Germany and France too to abandon their mercantilism? It would take a lot. And so you see European leaders trying to kind of temper US expectations. You have Emmanuel Macron in the news saying that they don't want to adopt this Cold War rhetoric. They don't want to be pulled into a geopolitical power struggle where Europe is viewed only as an object. You know, he's insisting that Europe is a subject in geopolitics and giving his classic speeches explaining why, you know, it's important for Europe to maintain its own autonomy and independence. And so I see a lot of political resistance among certainly the two largest EU member states to any really tougher approach to China still, although we might see with the NATO summit today that that could change depending. But then one, as you mentioned, as you pointed out in our editorial meeting last night, one politician who has actually been, I think you call it walking the talk, is Mario Draghi in Italy. So he said that Italy is going to reevaluate its participation in the Belt and Road Initiative. And he has also taken some moves recently to block Chinese takeovers of Italian companies, most notably a semiconductor company. So there is a difference of opinion in the EU right now that could see Europe, particularly, as you mentioned, if the Greens win in Germany or enter government there, that could see the EU move towards a more hardline position against China. But this, of course, entails its own risks because American military adventurism remains the same. And you can see a lot of US hawks calling for confrontation with China right now on Twitter and in the media. And that, I think, is a big cause for concern for the EU because nobody wants to be in a cold or hot war with China under any circumstances. And so this is going to be a really delicate and thorny issue for EU leaders and NATO leaders today, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty will be for them to build up a position of strength towards China, but without a position of in which it descends into hostility. Yeah. And they have gone very far in a sort of a laissez-faire. They allowed Chinese to take over very strategic European assets in a way that China never reciprocated.
Yeah.
In Italy, this has gone far further than in other countries. We reported extensively on the Belt and Road contracts that Italy and China had concluded under previous Italian governments. And possibly this is Draghi's most important legacy.
Absolutely.
We can't say that he did a particularly good job, or his administration did a particularly good job on vaccination compared to the previous administration. The recovery fund is in slightly less politicized than it was under the previous administration, but we don't think the recovery fund is the big game changer for the EU one way or the other. So this is not sort of an issue that we have prioritized on. It's far too small for that to happen. And also Draghi is not going to be in power for that much longer. I mean, he's, you know, we take him as a one-year prime minister. And he, you know, we think him most likely to succeed Mattarella as president of the Republic in January when the vote is cast on his succession. So that will give Draghi another 7 months in office, which, you know, he is a classic Italian interim, you know, technical leader who will have probably end up with more than most other technical leaders of the past. And he is wise enough not to know that he's not a politician, so that he's not going to try to form his own party or anything like that. And there will almost certainly be a government of the right, as it looks at the moment. The Fratelli d'Italia are becoming stronger and stronger. They're now as big as the Partito Democratico, almost as big as the Lega. They're all polling at about 20%. Different polls give different leads to different parties, but they're all pretty much in the same vicinity of around 20%. And that will invariably mean a government of the right. And then the question becomes, will that position that Draghi just built up survive? There is a chance it might. Foreign policy is slightly different from domestic policy, but the, you know, Italy will need inward investment. That's the question is, where will it come from?
Yeah, absolutely. It's some tough choices lie ahead, definitely, for Europe.
One of the discussions at the G7, we heard Macron making this extraordinary claim that Northern Ireland was not in the UK.
I was just about to mention that.
What was it?
Whoops.
Whoops. Whoops. And it all started with the Toulouse sausage,
I
right?
I feel like that was a trap that he walked into, right? Like, they had to have known that he was going to say something like that. Yeah.
I agree. I mean, it was such a setup. And in a way, it was amazing that he fell for it, talking about Toulouse sausage. Boris Johnson just asking what you feel like if the Toulouse sausage could no longer be delivered in Paris. And Macron went for it and saying, well, it's not the same because we're in the same country. Of course, ignoring the basic fact that Northern Ireland is part of the UK.
Awkward.
I was contemplating this morning about how deliberate that was, because of course it serves a political purpose in the sense that it stirs up the stakes for the UK side, showing, see, I told you so, the EU has no understanding of the basics of Northern Ireland, nor does it any understanding of the details of the withdrawal agreement and what it means for the Northern Irish people. So I guess it really helps to build up their side in these negotiations. And it might actually end up politically giving them a very valid point of why they want to trigger Article 16, if they have to, in order to, when the next deadline comes up in end of June about the sausage meat and the meat in general. I mean, there are several deadlines further down the line, but this one seems to be so symbolic because sausage is such an English identification. It's such a thing. I mean, you just basically tell the Northern Irish people, well, you might not get the English sausage, so you might have to eat the Irish ones, which probably will have its own kind of ramifications in there. But it plays into a political drama that is actually unfolding in Northern Ireland itself in Stormont, because today, Arlene Foster steps down as a first minister, basically leaving that post to be occupied by the new nominee from the DUP party, which is Paul Gavin. But to be nominated, he needs the support of Sinn Féin. Michelle O'Neill is the deputy first minister. She had to step down with Arlene Foster as well, because this is a kind of co-leadership agreement. Now, the condition for them to back the new first minister is for Sinn Féin wants to have the Irish Language Act enacted by the DUP. The Irish Language Act would put the Irish language at par at the same level of the English language. So it's not hard to see how this stirs up emotions amongst unionists and loyalists. And they started marching this weekend with many of union flags around and talking about the British sovereignty that has been betrayed and feel really raw about it. And I talked to some in Northern Ireland saying, I've never seen so many union flags ahead of these marches, even in more affluent areas where you would normally not see so much of a display of their allegiance towards union, being part of the unionists. But what I'm just seeing is there's the Brexit, all the controls that happen, people traveling now to Northern Ireland having to have their handbags checked and pets can no longer cross to Scotland or England without a vaccination passport, all these little things, and the shelves in supermarkets are empty. But it takes longer to get all your shopping done because you have to source your shopping differently, and Amazon doesn't deliver all the products anymore to Northern Ireland. So this is the reality they're living in. It has very little to do with the factual kind of abstract adherence to single market rules. It just triggers the trauma of what it would be like, or feeling like being really triggered about what it means to be British. And I think that that aspect is true, that the EU seems to have no grasp of that, or what possibly could unleash because of these rules, as innocent they might be from the onset, but they have huge ramifications for the peace setting in Northern Ireland.
I could see a potential diplomatic disaster. You know, we've always been warning people, whether in East Europe or in this part of the world, against any blockades. Blockades is sort of the stuff that wars are made of. And you don't want to cut people off from supplies. That's generally a bad idea. The EU tends to overestimate its knowledge of the region. I noted that during the Brexit negotiations, when there was a lot of, you know, assumption that the EU was on top of the situation. This looks to us like a continuation of the Brexit wars by other means, but this is potentially much more dangerous. An Article 16 trigger is quite possible. You might recall that back in a year ago, we advocated that the UK and the EU do not agree a deal in order to prevent exactly the situation that is now arising. They've all decided that better off muddling through, and if they can muddle through, that might actually be the best outcome, if they muddle through this crisis and allow extensions so that there is a guaranteed supply. But if that cannot happen, then it would have been better had this trade agreement never been struck in the first place, because the disruption you would have had anyways, and we would have been in a position to build up rather than having to take things away. Article 16 is triggered, no doubt the EU will retaliate at some point, and much of the trade agreement will be undone. So we're basically back to some kind of WTO relationship between the EU and the UK, where we would have been had this agreement never been struck. The EU used the, you know, obviously the EU had a stronger negotiating position during the original negotiations of the withdrawal agreement, because the UK Parliament was divided.
Yeah.
And for most of that period, there was no majority in the EU for another agreement or for no deal. That's why we ended up with this very awkward agreement. And you all remember when Johnson came to power, then he swapped Theresa May's deal, which would have kept the UK in the single market for an extended transition period, for this sort of, obviously, everybody pointed it out at the time, illogical deal on Northern Ireland, which the lack of logic is not becoming clearly apparent. And, you know, it's not that he didn't know that. He knew that he would get to this point and he would do whatever he does now. So the British signed it up with a clear intention of not having to observe it to the letter. So the conflict is very clearly indicated. Potential for conflict here, definitely.
But it's interesting that you mentioned that, how they entered the no deal. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the debates we had with Greece, right? At the time when the sovereign debt crisis started, because at the time there was the debate whether they should take the short-term loss and then restart relationships with Greece from there. That was at the time rejected because it was just unthinkable that they would let go of Greece, and they all wanted to show the support and keep everything intact, which in the long term actually made Greece very dependent of three bailouts and massive amounts of public debt now on their leverage. So in a way, it actually worsened the relationship rather than bettered it. It was a short-term pain, would have been probably easier to digest, and yet we chose the other way.
Yeah, so European, the tragedy of the modern EU.
Okay, well, guys, I can hear the birds singing outside, and it is extremely hot here in France too. Is there anything else we want to discuss, or should we maybe call it a day?
We call it a day.
All right, good. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Until next time.